MG is back, and it's electric. The MG ZS EV. From just €28,995, the truly affordable, family-friendly electric range. Go to mg.ie and recharge your soul.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the second chapter of our Ask Me Anything edition of the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. We asked you, our listeners, to send in questions for us to answer, and just a note that we did record this podcast just before Christmas, so it is always possible that something that we said may have been overtaken by events. Anyway, before we get going, I do want to draw your attention to the Irish Times' upcoming Winter Nights Festival, which features a range of in-depth discussions between various Irish Times journalists, including myself, and significant public figures, everybody from Edna O'Brien to Dara O'Brien to Nicola Sturgeon to Micheál Martin and many, many more. The festival runs online from January the 25th to the 29th, and tickets are €50 or €25 for Irish Times subscribers. Just go to irishtimes.com/winternights to find out more. And with us on today's show, the full politics team of Pat Leahy, Harry McGee, Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones. So let's get straight to it. A couple of questions about the third party in government, the Green Party, Harry, which I'd like you to address, please. Kieran O'Sullivan says, given the compromise and infighting since joining the government, is there any route for the Greens to retain any seats at all in the next general election? And then Emma Maskman on Twitter asks, with all the Green Party drama this year, will a new eco-party form in the next 5 years?
Yeah, they're very interesting questions, Hugh, and I'll deal with them one by one. I think the Greens are going to find, I mean, they found government extraordinarily difficult the last time because they ended up losing all of their seats, but it happened during an unprecedented economic crisis. I think they will have difficulties here. I think COVID in the opening years of government will present a difficulty for them. I think the second difficulty for the Greens is that they're not the smaller party in a two-party government. They're the smaller party in a three-party government. And I think the way the dynamics of that coalition will work is that the Greens will struggle to get their message and to get their policies across. They did exceedingly well in the budget in terms of getting green issues across the line. The difficulty with a lot of green issues is that it takes a long time between decision and implementation. And the fruits of some of those policies will not be witnessed until long after the Greens have departed from government. They haven't been helped by the infighting that's happened. And we saw another example of it this week with the row over this trade deal between Europe and Canada. So I think that the Greens will probably get an electoral mauling after the next election and will come back certainly diminished in numbers and might even be eviscerated. In relation to the prospect of a new Green Party or a new ecological or environmental or climate change party, I think the possibility of that is quite real. I think that some of the people who departed the Green Party were very motivated by some of the kind of the ground campaigns that have occurred in the past number of years and would have a more radical outlook than the Greens. And there's a kind of emerging of climate change policies with just transition, social justice policies that would place them very close to the parties on the left, like People Before Profit and the Socialist Party. There's a just transition ginger group there at the moment, which is semi-detached from the Green Party. And I think at some stage, I think that that is going to leave the Green Party and become a new party. How well it will do, we just don't know. But they could get one or two seats after the next election.
So, Jack, obviously Brexit figures in the questions which we've received in from listeners, and specifically the whole question of the relationship between this country and its nearest neighbour.
Hello, team. Leo from Cork here. How badly do the panel believe Anglo-Irish relations have been damaged by Brexit, Boris and the backstop? Thank you.
So I think inevitably they've been quite profoundly damaged. And I think that, you know, that's a function of Ireland's particular and peculiar role in the whole Brexit kind of psychodrama. You know, we are embedded into their economy in a way that that the rest of Europe isn't. We share the only external land border that they're going to have with the European Union. And also, partially as a function of those reasons and because of the difficult and vexed political conversations that had to be had around that border and how to manage it, the role of the DUP and the Theresa May government and all these different, you know, competing factors, Ireland and Irish politicians and to a large extent, Leo Varadkar, in a personalised sense, and to a lesser extent, some of his colleagues, you know, became totems in the pro-Brexit British political press. So, you know, we've become kind of reified in that debate in a way that is unusual for Irish politicians who don't usually, and the Irish political system, which doesn't usually get much of a seat at the table in terms of British current affairs or British public discourse. I think behind the scenes, like at official level, probably the damage hasn't been quite as profound. And I think you would find that there is still a semblance of decent working relationships between Whitehall and Dublin. But again, I think it's inevitable that, you know, the kind of toxic nature of British politics at the moment and the kind of haphazard seat of the pants brinksmanship that goes on has filtered down and made those relations more difficult. The question, I suppose, really is that, you know, with things so badly scarred arising from Brexit and you know, presuming that we get some kind of a trade deal, how or when will they be repaired, you know, and how will bilateral relations affect exports and imports between the two countries? Because, you know, we have to reach some kind of understanding for the sake of particularly the agri-food sector, because, you know, they are so dependent on the British market. So to sum it up, you know, quite badly damaged, and it is massively important that, you know, that damage is addressed going forward. I'm not quite sure exactly how we will do that. I would hope that if there is a kind of a quietening of British politics once Boris Johnson gets Brexit done, if things kind of revert to the mean and get a bit less hectic over there, then, you know, there will be an associated, you know, cooling of the tensions that exist between both Ireland and the UK and the EU and the UK. But, you know, there's a lot of ifs, what ifs and conditionals in there. And as with all things Brexit, it's not easy to be absolutely definitive about how or whether this is going to be fixed.
Pat, you've spoken on this podcast previously about the way that the bonds which have been built up since the peace process of the 1990s have been loosened by the Brexit process over the last couple of years. I mean, obviously there's a north-south element as well as the east-west trade one, which Jack was mentioning there. Maggie Stanfield and Dan Patrick says, I cannot envisage any way in which the muddled and convoluted mix of Northern Ireland to the EU for goods but not services and unable to export, import freely in and out of the UK can possibly work. As a passionate Remainer and also a committed nationalist, though with no party alignment, I see only one sensible and pragmatic way forward, a 32-county Ireland or a new Ireland or whatever nomenclature you might choose to use. What do you think?
Well, I think that's an argument that we will hear more and more of over the coming years. One of the things that's happened this year, and as far as we're supposed to be doing a review of the year here, is that I think the question of a united Ireland moved closer to the centre of political debate in the South. And that's due to a couple of things. Brexit, of course, it's due to a campaign, determined campaigning by pro-unity people, many of them in Sinn Féin, but extending beyond Sinn Féin as well. And it's due to the political success of Sinn Féin in the 2020 general election and for that party, the project of Irish unification is probably its single biggest priority. So I think we'll hear a lot more of it. As to the question of, you know, Anglo-Irish relations, I think Jack is right about the commercial and economic, the undermining of the commercial and economic links between the two countries and the very real fallout that there will be from that for many businesses, particularly in the agri-food, but not limited to that area. But I think possibly the biggest damage that has been done is that the government in Dublin no longer thinks that the government in the UK is that interested in or serious about Northern Ireland, And, you know, I think that sense of the, you know, the management of the latter stage peace process and the assistance and husbanding of the Good Friday institutions, assistance to and husbanding of the Good Friday institutions was very much a, when it worked well, was always a joint project by the government. I think there was something of a reviving of that when Julian Smith was the Northern Secretary, but he was the exception amongst recent Northern Secretaries in the British government. And I think that the present incumbent Brandon Lewis is a reversion to is probably a reversion to previous form in that regard. And I think that is one of the things. I think there's a very significant job of work, as Jack says, to be done in rebuilding relations at political and administrative level with between Dublin and London in the wake of Brexit. And that would be one of the most important aspects of it, I think.
Okay, well, talk of Irish unity inevitably brings us to questions about Sinn Féin. We've had quite a few of those. Here's one from Anthony Sheridan.
Why is the link between the rise of Sinn Féin and the ongoing disintegration of the political centre ignored by mainstream media? Almost all comment and analysis surrounding this historic evolution focuses on attacking Sinn Féin on behalf of and in defence of the political centre. There is virtually no analysis or comment as to why this is happening.
So thanks for that, Anthony. And I'm going to add to that a similar question from Cian Farrell, who says, how does the Irish Times and the media writ large deal with growing claims of bias against parties on the left? There does seem to be a bit of a revolving door between government buildings and Tara Street, which is clearly a massive conflict of interest. Would a ban on this practice similar to a lobbyist ban work? So these are both really about the relationship between the media and political parties and accusations, which we all know are out there, of a specific prejudice against Sinn Féin. Harry, what do you think?
Yeah, they're very interesting questions. And I don't think that you can completely rebut those arguments 100%. I think I reject both arguments and the premise behind them, but I don't reject them completely. And I'll say why. We're working in an environment that is like a big boarding school. And the thing is that you do forge relationships with politicians. And journalists depend on politicians, especially when they're looking for to get stories in advance. And that makes it slightly problematic when it comes to criticising politicians, that suddenly you have to pounce and bite the hand that feeds. And that is something that as a professional journalist, that you should be able to deal with. But again, going back to the frailty of the human condition, sometimes it's hard to come in very, very hard against somebody with whom you have, you know, that you've met around the place and know for a long time. Now, just in relation to Sinn Féin, I kind of reject that analysis of Sinn Féin that we're, you know, that all of the coverage is the centre defending itself and just having sideswipes at Sinn Féin. I don't think that's true at all. I think the Irish Times in particular has spent a lot of time trying to analyse why Sinn Féin has performed well and at times badly in Irish politics since its entry to national politics in 1997. And far from the mainstream attacking Sinn Féin, I think Sinn Féin is far more of a mainstream party itself now than it was when it entered Dáil Éireann almost 30 years ago now, over 30 years ago now.
Yeah,
so that the party itself has evolved.
Level or at least
and I think if the party does go into government, the party will be more of a mainstream government than one that would be identifiably left. I think Sinn Féin has had a different culture. I think its accession into Irish politics has made it a little bit more difficult in terms of getting access to its thinking. It has tended to be slightly more secretive, slightly more guarded, and slightly less willing to share its thinking in the past than the mainstream parties that have been around for a long time. And as we see from their parliamentary party meetings every week are completely and utterly dysfunctional when it comes to party discipline and what have you. So it's not so much that there has been any attempt to ward off Sinn Féin or to exclude Sinn Féin or to attack Sinn Féin. I think there has been just a difficulty in terms of getting access to Sinn Féin, but that has become less of a difficulty in recent years. So is the media biased against Sinn Féin? I think undoubtedly there are some commentators and some journalists who would be who would take a avowedly and markedly anti Sinn Féin stance. But we're not, you know, we're not statues. And I think that you have to be in a position as a journalist to criticize a party and criticize it as fairly as you possibly can. And I mean, it's past, and especially some of the more egregious things that happened in the north cannot be ignored. And they have to be brought into the equation when one is talking about Sinn Féin in the round. But the thing is that when you're analysing them, we're not analysing them in that context to the exclusion of everything else. That is just part of a more complex picture of a party that has been evolving. And also, on the other side, of a media industry or a media presence that has been evolving in its coverage of Sinn Féin as well.
Pat, what about this fence-jumping, revolving door question, which kind of does relate to this, because nobody's left the Irish Times or the Irish Independent to become an advisor to Sinn Féin. Fiac Kelly, our deputy political editor, left after the election to join Justice Minister Helen McEntee's team. A couple of years previously, Sarah Barden left to join Simon Harris. We've seen similar movement from the Independent News and Media's political group. So that does... that is read in a certain way out in the broader world, isn't it? Should we as journalists be concerned about how that's seen?
In a way, we're kind of the worst people to answer this question. I think it's one kind of for the readers to make up their minds on. I suppose one of the reasons why, and there's always been some traffic, I think, between political journalism and government, but it's the second, which in a way isn't surprising, given that, you know, just as journalists move between publications, so they move, you know, people move jobs in a similar area. Our two former colleagues that to which you refer have gone to work in government, in part because there were a lot of vacancies in government. Anytime a government is set up or there are changes in government, there are vacancies. Ministers hire advisors, press officers, and so forth. And a natural place for them to look will be amongst political journalists. So in that sense, it's not that surprising. And it is something that you tend to see in lots of places. I think on the broader, I think on the broader question, of which that is a, I suppose, is part, is goes to the heart of our, you know, fair and balanced and reasonable and hopefully intelligent coverage of politics. And, you know, the readers can make up their own minds. They can make up their own minds on that. For our part, what I can say is we strive to make it all of those things, as we're required to do, not just by the way we work and the expectations within the culture of the Irish Times, but as are laid down in the articles of the Irish Times Trust, which owns the Irish Times and which anybody can read on the newspaper's website. So, you know, all I can say, I suppose, to listeners who have concerns about it is that we are aware of those of concerns. They come from all sides of politics and from none. Tony O'Reilly, who used to own newspapers a million years ago, said all governments feel persecuted by newspapers and all oppositions feel ignored by newspapers. And I think, to be honest, that there may be something in that.
Jack, we're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon, but I gather that while we were recording this, you got an extra question in from somewhere in the corridors of power.
Yes, indeed. A top political source, or at least if this isn't damning with faint praise, a mid-level political source texts. and I responded saying I was doing this podcast, and they asked if they had any questions. And the question is this: what scoop from this year do you wish was yours, national or international?
Ooh. Jennifer?
International. Wouldn't it have been amazing to have got that story about, the full story about Trump's tax returns? Could you imagine, after all the years of what's in those documents, what's in his tax returns, what is he hiding, what is the state of affairs with the outgoing president, to actually get all those details in black and white and then press go, you know, press publish and watch it go out into the world and watch everybody absorb it. I think that would have been phenomenal.
Jack, your preferred scoop?
I would have taken Golfgate. I would have taken your hand. I would have taken your hand off to get Golfgate. I mean, a fantastic scoop by Aoife Grace Moore and Paul Hosford in The Examiner. And you know, it's one that you know, it's still going on. You know, the fallout from it, and you know, it's spawned associated you know, sub crises and sub controversies, most notably the Seamus Wolfe appointment. And you know, it's one that, like, other publications have kind of distinguished themselves as well, in terms of, you know, there's been so many follow-up stories and new folds developing, and the ongoing and rolling coverage of, you know, the Phil Hogan back and forth, and the extraordinary interactions with Ursula von der Leyen. You know, it was just a fantastic story. And you know, it was really interesting from a political point of view as well, because I think it told us a lot about how people perceive politics. Now, I don't think that, you know, the gathering in the West was in any way like, you know, an elite kind of Bilderberg type cabal that got together to figure out how to ignore the COVID regs and carve up their various interests in the country at the same time. But I do think it's telling that people kind of perceived it as such. People perceived it as a political elite thumbing its nose at the ordinary people, which kind of plays into a lot of the tropes of populism. And the reaction to it, and how annoyed people were, how viscerally angry people were about it, I think told us a lot about some of the more unsettling directions that politics in Ireland is or could be moving in as well.
Yeah, I suppose it's a shame. My favourite, it just shows how low my standards are, is the one about the Hungarian MEP who wrote Viktor Orban's anti-LGBT constitution, who was found cavorting at an all-male sex party in Brussels. I think that's a story for the ages. Pat, what about you?
I think the story that I'm sorry that we didn't do was to foresee just how serious the pandemic would be, and interrogate parties a bit more during the general election about what they would do faced with the challenges of a pandemic in government. I think we were probably, maybe because we were all knackered after the general election campaign, I think we were perhaps a bit slow to switch on to how serious the pandemic would be. I mean, just a month after the general election took place, we were staring into a lockdown. And I think if we had been paying a bit more attention to international events, and maybe there's a lesson for us there to put our heads up from time to time and look at international trends and see how they are likely to impact our country and its politics, I think maybe we might have asked a few more questions about that.
On that very good and cautionary note, we shall leave it there for this podcast, and indeed for this year. Thanks to Pat, to Jack, to Jen, and to Harry. Wishing you all a very happy Christmas and a peaceful new year, which I think it's almost certain to be, given the circumstances. And we'll be back in your feeds in January. But until then, goodbye and good luck.